Hello and welcome to No Killing Goblins, the Wandering Inn fan podcast. I am your host today, Dragonus, with one of our special guest hosts, Hicks.
Hello, yes, I am the Hicks that he's just mentioned. I've been with you once or twice before.
Indeed. I think you were in for our big Ryoka chapter, which was definitely a crazy time when she was breaking that Geas and had all those big internal monologues. Anyways, it's
Everyone
go
loves
on.
to identify with the person with a crippling self-doubt and constant introspection to everything they do, and listening to the other people talk about the Wandering Inn with the round table. Because nothing's more insufferable than a Wandering Inn fan.
Indeed. And God, actually, I was just thinking about, like, yeah, everybody loves to identify with the kid. No, they don't. Everybody hates Ryoka, except for all the people who tell us we're too hard on her, but I'm convinced they're figments of Oshi's imagination.
Or Ryoka's, one of the two. There's plenty of room in there. There's crazy for everybody. Although everybody knows that the real sin of Ryoka is just not respecting the true protagonist of this story and the focus of next week's chapter, Perjua.
Yeah, as we all know, Persua will eventually redeem herself and become everyone's favorite character and be beloved by the whole community.
I, for one, believe that this is just one long setup for a Perjua the Magical Girl joke, and I'm here for it.
So I have had a pretty crazy week. I dropped my phone, so I had to scramble to go buy a new one. Got into a car accident today. Just a minor fender bender, but still, it was a lot of time standing in 90-degree heat waiting for a cop to show up to take a report. Then I get back to my office, and I get an email saying, "Hey, this apartment complex on your street burned down. Are you okay? Do you know if this was you?"
Do you
It was
know if
not.
this is you?
Yeah.
How does one's apartment burn down and you not be aware of it? That seems like
Well,
something
it
that's hard to
would have
su-
burned down while I was at work. Getting the police report done for my fender bender.
All right, I guess that tracks. Contradicting me and my baseless accusations about your imaginary arson problem.
It wasn't, thankfully, although it is less than a mile from my house, and there is a great deal of woods around here. So, I am just, I've had definitely had a fucking week. I had a little heart attack right there.
I mean, it's the
Other than
American
that.
Southeast. We have plenty of problems, but burning down is not one of the ones we've chosen.
I mean, you say that, but when we burn down, we do it with style. God, I still feel sorry for fucking Gatlinburg. For those who aren't in the know, Gatlinburg is where Dollywood is at. Dollywood is where Dolly Parton lives. She is a national treasure. I will not be contradicted on this. And the whole place burned down a few years ago. And they built it back up. And then it had another fire. Yeah, it happens down here more than you'd think.
Don't lie to your viewers, Tennessee isn't a real place. I mean, why wouldn't it be a real place? The Tennessee Valley Authority told me it wasn't. Everybody respects
Oh, I
them.
want to talk about the TVA. Anyways, before we get
Speaking of
too
unspeakable
wildly.
blights on the countrywide scale.
You know what? I actually like the TVA, kind of. Anyways, I don't even want to get into that whole deep, dark, specifically niche Southeastern subject, especially not when half this podcast still technically n lives in New York.
Well,
Even if he's not here today.
I feel like I should apologize to Oshi for that. For living in New
Why?
York. It seems like
Oh,
something someone should
no.
send a card for, or a fruit basket.
Oshi defends and loves New York City, and honestly, it seems like a nice place. I just wish that it wasn't the worst city in the country to drive in a truck.
I mean, when you're like, face superhero is only Spider-Man. Like, is your city really, is your ceiling that high? Are your expect
Okay, yes, it is, because Spider-Man is one of the best heroes in comic books. Before the big comic book boom, he made more money than Jesus. Spider-Man 2 was the movie that beat Passion of the Christ in the box office, Hicks. Don't disrespect the spider.
I have such intense respect for that incredibly incredibly on point comparison. I have no words of contradiction. I'm just in awe of those things that you just strung together and called a statement.
It was, in fact, very on point. And no, really, think about it, though. Back in, like, the 90s, before we had all these comic book movies, before Blade and X-Men even dropped and sort of peeked that door open, there were three comic book heroes that people who were not comic book nerds knew. Batman, Superman, Spider-Man.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Spider-Man's legit. And his game's fucking great, I said, years late, now that it's finally out on a reasonable platform like PC.
Okay. Am I allowed to say hateful things about people with console exclusives? Is that a demographic that we're pandering to?
You know, technically it probably is, but I'll say hateful things because they still own Fist of the North Star and I don't.
Alright, well, I will not attempt to dissuade you on your crusade there. That's between you and your deity of choice.
I'm just saying, like, if I buy that game on PC, it's not a lost PS4 sale, Sony. You could have put it out on PC ages ago. The crossover is not that deep. And for the people where there is crossover, they probably would have preferred it on PS4, so you still got your sale. Anyways, we are here today to talk about our Lord and Savior, the Antinium Wars.
I mean, if you say so.
Yeah, I don't even know why I said that. Every time I say the words, we are gathered here today, I just feel a compelling need to use the phrase, our Lord and Savior.
Well, the Antinium Wars are fascinating. They're something that really does inform so much of the setting, even if we do spend a pretty significant number of words not knowing anything about them factually and not contextualizing what it means for the characters. It is the watershed event in recent history for so much of the cast.
Yeah, and it's so interesting the way that, like, we don't get to know about it, despite the fact that it informs so much about what is going on in the setting.
We do get good information. We just get it now, instead of at the beginning of the book, where everyone is still hating ants. And you start the book off, coming from, you know, Aaron's perspective, where everyone is all these fantasy races, and also we're bigoted at this one in particular.
Yeah, and I do also really like the way that these chapters are framed, because the idea of framing it as an in-universe piece of non-fiction history is a interesting choice from Pirate and not something that they normally do. I do appreciate this sort of humble, just the facts. I like in his opening when he talks about how so much of what needs to be talked about here is based off of trying to put stuff together from eyewitness accounts and really build the narrative from the voices of the people that were there and then kind of boil it together to tell this story. This story that sort of opens up with us finding out that the Antinium are fuck-ups.
Yeah, the Antinium, the Black Horde, the plague on Israel, are here and what they are because they dropped the ball on stage two of the plan. They did not make it to ? Let alone profit.
Yeah, and like the book even straight up calls it out in the very beginning. That mistake cost them the continent because they didn't water good. And they did not do a great job with the oceaning. Right after they went and they kicked over the Blighted King, the walls were stormed, the, like, people that we know of as these defenders against the fucking unknown horrors and the demons, the people who we know have summoned forth the Earthers to try and defend and save themselves, got their teeth kicked in.
Yeah, like, the Antinium, like, are seeing this ongoing conflict that has lasted so long that it is at a functional stalemate, even if it does have its, you know, millennia scale back and forths. And they just walked up and they not only pulled the ball out from under Charlie Brown, but they spiked it in his face and then took his wagon to go sail across the sea in it. And with about as much success.
Yeah, and to add insult to injury, they crashed the wagon on the way to where they were going.
Yeah, they are not good at water And we have some limited insight into how bad they are at water, but they lost just tremendous numbers, both in important people and bodies on the ground.
Yeah, and like all we really know at this point is that it's over 200 ships leave, four arrive, and it's such like a distinctly quiet, almost limp entrance that they don't even get noticed. Not until they've had time to build up and start their own horror movie plot.
Yeah, and the way they start is fascinating because the Entinium start the same way that people do it, treat them to a lot of degrees. They treat them as a monster infestation. Oh, some people have gone missing, and some people saw some spooky stuff up in the hill. Someone should do something about that. Not me, that's what bounties are for.
Yep, and it is also sort of interesting the way that we almost immediately find out that despite how secretive they were trying to be, they didn't want to start a panic, Lady Magnolia just knows. No one knows how she figured it out. They assume that it's magic. I just assume Magnolia has a highly competent spy network that are probably all maids.
I mean, everything is explicitly maids all the way down with Magnolia.
Sometimes it's butlers.
I would not be surprised if the butler was also a maid. Like, has like three or four levels of just trying something and it not working and just being forever ashamed of the fact that he has four levels of maid. Reynold thinks about that at night. He doesn't like it, but he does.
we also find out some interesting stuff just about the Army of Lascaur, which is this, central place to our story. We haven't found out much about them so far, but now we find out it's one of the strongest forces on the continent. They work as mercenaries, and they are constantly out there fighting. We get to see some interesting stuff from General Saris of Lascaur, and I really love how, in the middle of this story being told as an in-universe book, the book itself uses a lot of epistolary stuff with letters from home from Ceres.
Ah, yes. Chrysostyle Wordsmith earning his reputation for this book as a, as his seminal work by citing his sources like a person. I have strong feelings about this, and oral tradition, without pointing to your reason, is not worth it, and written tradition's not any better. It's just oral tradition with ink. I have strong opinions about people citing and not citing to their work, and I think it does speak to the fact that this is treated as a respectable scholarly work, that this is something where he has first-hand accounts and first-party written sources that he is citing to both factually and directly.
Yeah, I think this is also some of our first stuff that we're getting about the walled cities, right? Where we're finding out that, like, no, whatever Lyskor is, Lyskor may have walls, but it is not a capital W, capital C, walled city. Older than recorded history, 300-foot walls, never taken by siege, not even the Antinium actually managed to get through. Like, we know the Antinium dig like motherfuckers, and they couldn't even get through the foundations.
Yet the wall cities are just hacks. They are unfair, big, large cities with all of the stuff and all of the people, and drakes have no shortage of national pride or species pride, but they have, in a lot of respects, earned it. The walled cities are some real players, and they are just, this is some of our first look at why these entities have survived as long as they have and continue to flourish in a world where you have these extremely long time periods, and it's all the world is sort of defined by the fact that it is so old, and stuff there is old and rises and falls cyclically. The walled cities are a constant that you just are sort of singular entities in that respect and have very few comparisons.
Yeah, and it also equally efficient at defending themselves? Gnolls. Gnolls and guerrilla tactics.
They're dogs, dragonists, not gorillas.
I am not going to dignify that with a response.
Well, I will dignify it by following up on what you said. Guerrilla tactics are great. Mobility and the fact that the gnolls really do live and die by one of their emphasized advantages as a species, which is the fact that see good, smell good, hear even better. Gnolls know you're there. They know what's up, and they'll just fix it. They don't have to have walls because they have gnolls who know you're there and have a pointy thing and a stick with a string to throw it at you.
Yeah, and we know they have sort of a tribal structure, which also speaks to the way they organize the sort of hunting packs that are described that assist the main army, hitting stockpiles. It's hard enough for the Antinium, who are sort of this faceless horde that presumably has very solid, weirdly alien supply chains, and we already know something of what they eat, which is what's around, right? But it must be even fucking worse for an actual army to try and invade into that place when you just know that you're gonna have to split off extra units to screen
I
everything.
don't know what kind of supply train that ants even really have. I mean, I think that protecting the queen and the ant generation tools are the way that it works. But honestly, they don't. It's not like they have weapons they carry around. It's not like they need to eat. The best food they get are the people who are entitled to tunnel and get big, yummy mouthfuls of dirt to eat today. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. Let's go back to where we started. Let's track this invasion. The ants did start as what is functionally a monster infestation writ large. But after
Yeah.
that, we do see that the cities do stumble across them and they react badly. They do, and by which I mean they don't react enough to what this problem is. You have an infestation of something dangerous and unknown, and they just rely on adventurers they'll fix it eventually.
Which is kind of a weakness of a setting that has adventures in it. Like, you can just kind of t sometimes be overly reliant on them. And God, it almost reminds me a little bit of the way in Goblin Slayer you have this sort of apathetic response to this problem where it's like, eh, what? Goblins are a horrible infestation? Eh, send the newbies out to deal with it. Goblins don't pay well enough. This is a minor problem. We have demon lords to deal with. And it's almost like they're like, eh, send in some adventurers. If that doesn't work out, send in some more adventurers. And oh my God, why is there an army on our doorstep?
And we do see that it does escalate very, very quickly from, oh, hey, we sent some adventurers out. They found something. We don't really have any proof of what it is. It's gone now. We burnt it. I believe they burnt the bodies, and that was why they lacked proof at the beginning. But you go very quickly from, oh, look, some adventurers found a thing. They punched it, to, has anybody checked on that city lately? We haven't heard anything from them, and it's gone.
Yeah, they definitely hit their losses. It's stated they never make really significant advances into the Gnolls, but frankly, like the Gnolls can probably hold off an arbitrary number of Antinium right up until attrition just would cause them to collapse. They know that they can handle the Gnolls. They just need to kind of button up everything else so they can focus on them, which means dealing with the walled cities, which means trying to get their ground, which means walking face first into a very angry General Ceres, who at, oh God, what was that pass? Give me a moment. I've lost my place. There's one spot where he's just like, listen, if we retreat any further than this, this is their foothold. They come through this pass, we're done.
The Shivering Falls
We
Pass.
Shivering Falls, and he just rallies and says, fuck it, I'm not moving. Although he says it much more eloquently.
Zell Shivertail, or sorry, not Zell Shivertail, Saris, I'm not moving. Make me. And that kind of works out. And then people go, oh, look, that's working out, and he would like more people. Well, that seems like a good idea, because while we were doing our plan, it turns out that we don't have enough people to go fight all of the ants at once, and if we use our defensive walls to protect ourselves, they will just chew on us one at a time, forming little literal ramps out of ant corpses so that the other ants can get inside.
Yeah, and you know, despite how uneloquently I put it and how simply he puts it, I love the way that we get this really strong character from General Saris. The way that he comes across is almost sort of poetic. Like, I believe that he really did tell this really great 3-4 sentence speech, right? Like, there's no time for spectacles, no mighty oaths or solemn vows. Here is my enemy, here we stand, I will not take a single step backwards. Who will guard my tail? Like, you read the rest of his writing and you think, fuck yeah, this guy probably did just come up with that off the top of his head. This isn't something made up after the fact. Yeah,
this is not a speechwriter's, like, post facto insertion. This is not something from someone who's trying to be, you know, big and impressive in the way that someone speaking to a crowd might be. This is someone who's very salt of the earth. This is my job. This is your job. We're going to do this job. Let's do it good. Good job.
And also something that I think is underestimated in most kinds of fiction that deal with military stuff, the importance of morale, right? Like, one lost battle isn't that big for the Antinium, but knowing that the battle isn't lost is really important for the Drakes.
And speaking of morale, we do have this sort of unique experience with the Antinium, where every indicator is that they are immune to morale, that they are just drones in a way that, you know, traditional non-fictional race ants can be, where they are extensions of the queens of the hive, where the black tide knows no losses, the black tide knows no retreat. Killing one ant soldier just means the next one is going to step forward. And on top of having this advantage of not routing, this sort of like self-creating propaganda of the black tide as an entity really does do a lot to make this group more effective, because you do have this sort of faceless, nameless mob where it's hard to differentiate one individual entity from the next, and it creates this effect that is in and of itself deleterious to morale from them being immune to morale as a detriment.
Yeah, and I think that's why Zell knew that for as much morale reasons as the logistical doom that would come for it, they had to go on the offensive. And it's really cool to me the way that he just kind of sends out this message to everybody when he's being pressured to do this, do that, the other thing's like, no, we're doing this my way. We're only going to do this if we fight them. If we're cowards, we die, period. And there's a line at the end of his last letter of this first chapter, Drakes do not run, that is, I don't know if he initially said it or if he was quoting something, because I don't know if it was mentioned before this chapter, but oh boy, is it mentioned after. It almost feels like his words are echoing throughout the story and Drake culture for almost the whole series. It's just not really apparent until every now and then one of them says that occasionally valiant, occasionally stupid phrase.
And it is. It really does speak to the fact that this is sort of a unique thing, because this is, the Black Tide is a problem on a continental scale. As we discussed a minute ago, this is something that broke itself, and that's the only reason they did not take the continent in one swing. And the fact that this is something that is not the city of, like, one of the walled cities dealing with it, it is Drake's dealing with it, is a real statement to what is required, because we know how many people are on these continents. We know that the walled, from this chapter, that the walled cities are real singular entities that are extremely powerful and extremely well equipped as a singular entity. And yet that's not enough. This is not a problem for one walled city. This is a problem for Drake's, and honestly, a problem for Israel. That really is like one of the only ways that you can really communicate the magnitude of the problem that this is by introducing these walled cities that just dwarf comparisons to the more mundane things that the Drakes and Israel have shown us so far, and say they all teamed up and they still got jobbed.
Yeah. And as we close this one out, there is some interesting stuff in Pirate's first chapter note, which is, Pirate themselves talk about how this is a different style of writing and it reveals some interesting information and one of the Patreon ones. But apparently, this got released on the Patreon, quote, a long time ago. So this was earlier on when I guess there was more of a lead on when Patreon stuff was getting released. So that definitely is kind of interesting the way that this chapter can color so much of how you think about the series, and only some people were like on one interpretation, other people were on the other. That must have been an interesting time for conversation.
I do not envy the people moderating those poor spoiler channels. By which I mean the
Sorry.
non-spoiler channels.
Yeah, you are breaking up just a little bit coming through on my end.
Is this any better?
A little, yeah.
I apologize. Microphone bad.
Nah, no problem. I'm on a crappy headset mic. I keep meaning to buy a better one.
I have a better one. It's sitting over there to the side somewhere. I wish I'd thought to put it on, to activate it before we started this, but we're in too deep.
Indeed, we are. And to get in a little bit deeper onto this second chapter, we sort of hit the second half, the turning point post-Ceres. And it is interesting the way that the story kind of makes it clear right from the beginning that he is a brilliant, high-level strategic genius. He's high level. He can turn a battlefield just by his presence, but there's exactly one of him on this continent, and he's going to have a long time slowing the Antinium down.
Drakes do not run except from one fire to the other, frantically putting it out.
It's also interesting the way that it sort of frames it like maybe the Black Tide themselves did not realize what they were getting into, as they talk about how the warring Nole tribes and the Drakes managed to come together when they don't normally have this one singular rival like Rear does with the Blighted Kingdom and the demons. And it's definitely a different scenario, if only because the more variety you have in army types and in commanders, in cultural ways of thinking, the better things are when you bring that all to the table together.
Yeah, we see in this second chapter, we start seeing the first descriptions of what a Drake army is, what a Nole army is, what a human army is, and how they're different from each other. Like, we see these descriptions of Drake armies as these immovable objects of these heavy infantry powerhouses. You see descriptions of Noles as hunting parties, as archers and raiders, and then you see humans who are differentiated insofar as the ones from Magnolia are representative of the greater whole as people who are unique in their variety, in that you have these cavalry units and these mage units that are not inaccessible to other, races and groups. They're just not used like they are here.
Yeah, it's really interesting the way they almost feel like they have this traditional combined arms type setup, a bit of everything, and they are just a little bit able to react and handle multiple kinds of threats. Whereas, if anything, Drakes, as sort of these heavy infantry, I'm not moving today type people, are probably the ideal people to have hit the Antinium first. They definitely went to go chew something up and choked on it.
I will say that the description of how cavalry and ants interact does seem to indicate that ants do not have a good answer to horses.
No. They have no real good answer to horses, and they also struggle a bit with the level gap. They very clearly are just paying for something about all the people that they have with not having them be very high level, if they have levels at
I
all.
mean, we do see
And
a comparison. I believe it is in the, it may be in the first chapter, it may be in the second chapter, that the ant warriors are roughly comparable to a level 15 warrior or soldier. So this is someone who is not, they're not inexperienced. This is not that ants are bad at their job, but an ant soldier is not comparable to the elites or the specialty units, let alone the sort of heroes that leveling can produce, like Ceres.
Or, if you want to talk about leveling, biting the Antinium in the ass, let's talk a little bit about the message Ceres gets, which was delivered by a single lone human courier, Michaela Godfrey. Remember that name. The one person who broke through to deliver a message to General Ceres. And, to compare the different ways that, like, characters write, because this is a story being written in the in-universe voice of one character with the in-universe letters of other characters. And we've met Zell Shivertail already, and I like the way that this sort of plain letter, I'm trying to find the right way to describe his writing style, because something about Ceres feels like he's always talking in a I am the general giving a speech type voice, and Zell's just really matter of a fact right until the end when he really loudly and aggressively declares, "We are still alive and we're going to fight until we're
I'll
dead."
tell you what it is. It's these short factual sentences that are just short statement, period. Short statement, period. It's very matter of fact. It's very unembellished. It just is what it is. Spoken off the cuff, spoken like someone who wants to do a job.
And I am a sucker for glorious last stands. Just about the fastest way for a book to get a cheap pop and make me tear up a little is glorious last stands. And I just love how he's like, "Listen, we're writing to let you know we're alive, and we're requesting you not reinforce us. Every ant here is an ant not bothering people elsewhere, and we will stab them till our hands fall off." And the immediate response is to say, "Oh, fuck that. No, we need more people like you. Get over there." And we learn a little bit about the wonderful, magical thing about levels, adversity.
If things are hard, levels come faster. If things are still hard, the levels keep coming. And if things are really hard for a long time and you don't have any way to make them not hard, suddenly they do get less hard because you have leveled up 18 times and have acquired 4 new skills, and this system being the spiteful little creation that it is, those skills are probably tailor-made to fix this problem right here.
Yeah, you're getting something that, even if it's just a random skill, you're getting a lot of them in a hurry. And if it's not a random skill, you're getting what you need. And they even mention the rare classes thing, where you're getting really specific to what you're doing classes. And if what you're doing is a desperate holdout siege where you're determined not to die, you might get some random crazy shit like Slaughterer and Blood Berserker.
Yeah, and that really is where the ants hit their problem, because there's a power gap, but it's these silver bullets that do, I think, end up creating the problem. Because the ants have an answer where if you continue to throw, like, they're gonna throw rocks so many times that paper's tired today. But sometimes you just do get dynamite, and that's bad for Rock.
Yeah, like, levels are bullshit, and the system is kind of bullshit. And I love how it's like, no, we have to break the siege. And it's, on the one hand, it's very clearly a, we can't let these people die here. But on the other hand, it's, oh god, if we save these people, we are going to get, like, a core defensive group of high-level, battle-tested, capable people who are just ideally what I need right now, because I can only be in one place at once. And Zell Shivertail comes with it, and Ceres talks a lot about how, like, him and Zell are just an immediate sort of fast friendship kind of thing. Even Ceres, the great general, admires him.
Yeah, they really hit it off, and they do work exceptionally well as a tandem. Like, I believe, although this may need to be cut if I'm transposing things from Antony Mort's. Excuse me, you may need to cut this. I may be transposing something from memory from Ant Wars 2. But I believe there's a description in one of these about Zell working as the shield to Ceres' hammer, where there's a real dichotomy of attack and defense, hold and push. Oh no, it has to be this one because of the end of this chapter.
Probably, yeah. And okay, what was I saying? Oh yeah, they have the Antinium on the back foot, and they're starting to win and push things back. And now we have the Liscor is about to collapse, and Zell or General Ceres is about to lose his home.
And then he doesn't. Surprise! Liscor still exists. We've been there before, kids.
What a terrible surprise. But the big surprise here, though, is why it survived. And once again, Ceres, in his personal diary, has this sort of eloquent, poetic description, a battle horn, a call to arms, just past dawn, and then humans just roll in and kick some fucking ass. With a young Magnolia Reinhardt at her center.
She's never done anything important before. You can probably forget about her.
Yeah, no, she's not a very important character. And I like how they describe her seizing power as a swift bloodless coup. I wonder how much somebody had to pay to ensure the word bloodless made it in there. Actually, it could be bloodless if you'd use enough poison.
I mean, in all perfect fairness, I think it might be a relatively true statement.
True. She up to the story this far, though, has come across as a pretty cold motherfucker when she wants to be or needs to be. But yeah, she's not, like, you know, just spiteful, mean-spirited, ruthless, you know, kill people to kill them kind of a thing. But we find out that she dumped a lot of money into this one, because she caught on to the same thing despite not being there. Elite special units, buy the gold adventures, buy them.
Yeah, you bring in cavalry, you bring in mages, you bring in high-level adventurers, because the Antinium do not have more than a handful of ways to fix this problem. It turns out that if you have answers that can just answer arbitrary numbers of level 15 warrior without magical equipment, the ants struggle with that.
Yeah, and we also get a really interesting description of Magnolia, who we know of as this fairly cold, calculating figure, unflappable while she's dealt with Ryoka, managed to handle and meet Eren with a minimum of gasping in shock and what the fuck is going on here. And we see her crying, vomiting, and pale and shaky. And
out of character is serious business.
Yeah. Also, I love what Zell says. If she had half the cunning, bravery, and skill on the battlefield as she did in the realm of politics, I fear we'd be in more danger from the humans than the Antinium.
Magnolia Reinhardt, a stone-cold motherfucker.
Yeah, except for, in battle, they're not so much. And honestly, it feels like that was sort of the all is lost moment, and the narrative of the war quickly sort of combines itself together and rolls up towards the inevitable endpoint of suicidally deciding to go on an attack against one of the queens, because presumably if we get rid of them, we can do something against all odds, against all the people involved in all the various councils telling him, no, don't do this. This is a bad idea. He once again continues to be the big picture guy. Attrition, problem, bad.
I mean, I will say that this is prefaced by the Drakes discovering that the best way to be original is to steal violently and using the ants' natural weakness against them, wet, by
Yep,
using
they
mages to
can't.
just put water on them until they stop living.
And it's a brilliant combined arms tactic, too. They can't swim, so you take the drakes and you button up that hive. You don't let them out. You have the humans who have all the money to buy all the mages, all the scrolls, all of the rain spells. You have this big continental united moment, and they drown something like 300,000 ants and murder a queen.
And this had no side effects for anyone or anywhere.
Except for, all of the fucking water going away in that area for a long time.
No side effects for anyone anywhere. But,
And
go ahead.
Here, though, as we kind of see things continue, we get, oh God, it almost feels like a tragedy in that classical sense, where General Ceres has time and again pushed forward and hammered the enemy, and every time he's been told to slow down or stop, he has correctly said, no, it's too early to stop. We have to keep pushing. This is an enemy with a critical mass, and we can't let them hit it. And he keeps hitting them and hitting them and hitting them. And then he says we need to go one more time.
And that works out well and has no consequences for anyone.
Even Zell Shivertail told him not to go, that this was the time to stop. But he took the Grand Army, the first unified army of this continent of humans, gnolls, and drakes, marched forth with couriers and mages in constant contact. This is a high-level, highly equipped, highly skilled force led by the greatest general on the continent, and they disappear overnight without a single fucking trace.
I thought I said no consequences for anyone, but it sounds to me like they just got wiped out.
Oh, there was consequences. And in what can only be described as a interesting, almost gesture. The only way to describe this is a gesture from that faceless Doom Horde. General Ceres, his diary, and his body are politely left to be found. And it's spooky. The thing I like about General Ceres being a character who can speak poetically and who can really set a mood is the mood he sets for the final attack. Like, this is the hour of my death, and then they just all died.
Yeah.
There are more kinds of Antinium than just soldiers and workers.
I'm sure we'll never ever see any of those. You know what? I choose to believe that the ants left his corpse out there out of fear that it might attract more rain. Because when he showed up at first, look at what happened. If they kick his corpse out, maybe they'll get to see the sun again.
Could be. I think they left his corpse there for the same reason why they were trying to make peace immediately afterwards. And that is, they had grasped that they had chewed on something they could not swallow. And just because they took a big bite out of it didn't guarantee anything. And from what.
And we do see evidence that this is one of the first times that we see the Antinium take a loss that they care about. Because everything that's been evidenced so far in this war has been that if you lose 50,000 Antinium soldiers, that's just 50,000 mouths I don't have to feed, so why don't we just make 50,000 more? But when they lose a queen, the first thing they do is horrible murder revenge, and the second thing they do is please don't do that again.
Yeah, and even then, like, if he just hadn't pushed and hadn't threatened just this, I'm going to hit the biggest target I can, I'm going to make myself too big to ignore, the peace may very well have been forthcoming shortly afterwards. And God, who knows what would have happened if Ceres had been alive for, what is this that happens next? Let me see. Further hostilities, Goblin King Rampage, Assault on Lascaur, Azkarash, Necromancy. Oh, that can't be interesting. I guess Ryoka just couldn't bother to finish before she went off to the high
This is
passes.
like you one of those time travel movies. You go back in time. What do you mean, World War One?
Yeah, I we had always heard it referred to as the Antinium Wars. I had never really considered the plural.
Yeah, the Antinium Wars. What do you mean, more than one? We won. General Ceres kicked them back into the Hive Lands. Nothing bad ever happened again, right? This was a once in a millennium, like, once in a lifetime problem. Nothing bad ever happened to Israel.
Nothing bad ever happened to Israel. I'm sorry, this story has many millions of words, and it's not a spoiler if I say that's a lie.
That's fair. Ryoka came to Israel.
Exactly.
Now that we've reached the end of our chapter, I have a question for you, Dragoness.
Go
So,
for it.
we've seen a phenomenon. So, we've got this counter-leveling phenomenon, and we do see this as a way that adversity directly leads to strength. And adversity in the time of war usually involves people dying. Is counter-leveling level one blood magic where you transmute lives into power?
No.
That's fair.
I mean, don't get me wrong. It's maybe not level one blood magic transmuting lives into power in a literal sense, but in a figurative sense, it kind of is like it's almost like you're just going to take 10,000 people, dump them into a valley battle royale style, and say anybody who's under level 30 isn't allowed to leave. Here's your one day of food and a rusty spoon. And just saying, oh, look at all the high-level people wandering out. But, in a more ethical way, unless you're starting a shitty war just to level people, or if you're the invader, which it's hard to counter-level as the invader, I guess, but not impossible.
Yeah, you have to really get reverse Uno carded for that to happen.
Yeah,
Although,
you have to have picked a really bad target to invade into.
you just wander up into
Spoilers!
and start kicking things over. Now, you've brought this up, and I don't think we've seen this in the prospect of the artificial counter leveling, putting people intentionally into, like, truly damning situations just to force power leveling out of them, and I'm not sure we've seen an example of that, and I'm a little surprised that that hasn't been brought up as some, like, way to demonstrate that something is just awful. You know, throw some people into the blender pit and see who climbs out.
My ongoing theory is that that's what the ritual rear did is. I think that like so they mention the heroes in the big group text, right? The rear group. That because they have hero levels, they think that's why they're leveling so much faster. But we know Eren's levels, and we've seen how much leveling Ryoka would have gotten. If she hadn't denied some of the level ups. So it's not just people with hero, but it is people that are dropped into by default incredibly stressful situations. And I think that that's what the ritual's for. We even see something like that with what happens in the clown chapters, where a few of these kids have come out the other end incredibly powerful, and in the case of the clown, incredibly broken people, and a lot of other people just died.
Yeah, but I'd argue that, it's not maybe intentionally designed that way. Whereas I honestly would have expected to see at some point in this, serialization, to see, Dark Lord Terriblus the Mighty with his baby gladiator pits. Where he, you just, it's like a daycare, but you throw, child soldiers in there.
Actually, something, Oshii calls this story War Crimes, Slice of Life a lot as like his big pitch for it. I'm just going to go ahead and say I appreciate the fact that children don't level efficiently until they've reached a certain age, an excellent way to just avoid the subject of child soldiers. It's the one war crime I don't think we see, or at least that we haven't seen yet. And I want to say one thing about Pirates chapter note. So I do like the way that Pirate mentions that changing up the style and do something different made them feel like they had become a better writer. Because I agree, and especially because they'd never written in this style before, I think they captured it incredibly well.
Yeah, I think that the, like we've discussed earlier, the framing device works. The, supposed first party sources work. The direct quotations in the context of a book work. And Pirate manages to make the voices feel distinct even when those voices are narrating in their own little snippets. The device works, and the parts that go together to create that device all individually work.
Yeah, and I'd like to leave this off with a question for our readers if anybody has an idea of what their class would be if they desperately counter-leveled in a siege. Slaughterer, Blood Berserker, Immortal Badass Warrior missing all of their limbs but still biting the ankle of that angry ant. Whatever your class would be, take a wild guess. I personally think I would
I'm
die.
sure
I
I
wouldn't get to counter level.
see, I'm sure I had a witty answer, but I've been wildly distracted by the image of that man with no limbs biting ankles.
I'm now just picturing a class where it's somebody who just does that. He isn't immortal, he isn't like super powered, he doesn't become invulnerable, he just can function no matter how many bits and pieces get taken off of him.
My counter level is I'm the guy who died to that guy. Honestly, real talk, like that guy is biting me to death.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and I hope that everybody has a great week. Good night.
You've been listening to No Killing Goblins. The music on No Killing Goblins was composed by System Glitch. They can be found at youtube.com/systemglitch. You can get in touch with us via our Twitter at NoKillingGoblin or email us at NoKillingGoblins with an S at gmail.com.